Daniel in the Kitchen talks about food. Daniel in the Kitchen talks recipes. Daniel in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Daniel in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions.
And adventures.
And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. Community Radio is a treasure. We are glad to be part of it, and thank you for joining us today. Well, hot, cold. It's been an interesting couple weeks of summer weather, Donna. This is really something. Beautiful day today.
Oh, wonderful week this week. Next week again, put on your sunbonnet. It's going to be hot.
It is. Well, we can do this because summer is not quite over.
It's okay. We're not having tornadoes or
wildfires,
tropical storms, or
hurricanes,
earthquakes. No. In fact, we have a drought.
Right. Oh, dear.
Everybody's getting something they don't want from the weatherman lately. So,
isn't that pretty much is? It's called Iowa weather, and it's weather around the world. So, Donna, what did you do this weekend?
Oh, boy, oh, boy. I had a very fun adventure. This is sort of my annual favorite food outing at this point in my life. Every year, the Nyman Ranch Pork Company has they call it the Hog Farmer Appreciation Celebration, and this year was their 25th year. It's, so Nyman Ranch, the pork part was founded by an Iowa farmer, Paul Willis, who's a very old friend of mine, and he decided that he was not going to build a CAFO. When that started happening in Iowa, that was not his style. So he kept on raising pigs the way he had always raised, in hoop houses. Well, he used to have the little pointy houses that were out scattered all over the fields. As a child, so he had always raised pigs that way. And he just kept doing it, and then he went about looking for a better marketing solution for him. So he got in touch with this guy that was marketing premium beef and lamb out in California named Bill Nyman, and Bill was very excited to have the pork. Now, it has grown into a very large, it involves 600 farmers, but it's still the family farmers grow the pigs, and then they can get a premium price for their product. And it has enabled actually a lot of farmers to keep, you know, staying on, like when there was a depressed price for pork, I've forgotten when that was, sometime in the last 30 years or something. Nyman, it was like it had gone down to, don't quote me on this, but something really low, like 8 cents a pound or something. Aww. Nobody can raise anything for 8 cents a pound. And Nyman Ranch was still paying 40 some cents a pound. So they are able to help the farmers grow. You know, they have a growing protocol, which is humane and no hormones and antibiotics. And they either have to be out pastured or in deep bedded hoop houses. So none of this gestation crate. And they work with breeding so that they get very fine tasting pork. They've added a new breed that they're calling the Iberian Duroc Achari, A-C-H-A-A-R-I pork.
The latest thing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So they're really working with flavor. So they sell to a lot of high-end, I mean, you can buy Nyman Ranch products in supermarkets all over the country, but largely their product goes to restaurants and high-end food service dining options that can afford to pay for this, where they're really looking for the quality of the flavor in the meat. So what they do is they bring in some of these chefs from, you know, exotic places. Where did they come from? There was one from Denver. There was one from Palm Beach, Florida, Park City, Utah, San Jose, and Austin, Texas. And they make 6 or 7 courses with pork in every course. So the idea is the chefs come and they get to go see the actual pig farmers. So there's a tour of, you know, so the chefs see where the food is coming from. And then the chefs make their kinds of foods that they serve in their restaurants. And the farmers come for a big dinner. So I show up with the farmers for the dinner because it's really good food. I have to say my favorite course this year was a gorgonzola dulce de leche brownie.
Brownie? Yeah.
But the gorgonzola, which is a really rich blue cheese, you don't taste the brownie and go, oh, this has blue cheese in it. She keeps the flavor level to it where it just adds like such a richness. It was really a brilliant idea and perfectly balanced. And then for the pork in it, she served it with a little fluff of whipped cream, and over the was a candied chicharroni. So it was like this salty porky sprinkle that went on over the whipped cream. It was perfect.
Ooh.
Yeah. It was a good dinner. There were things like Pueblo green chili braised pork cheeks, Iberian Duroc pork collar, that was an Indian flavored one, and then there was a porchetta with black garlic, and then a Yucatan one with I can't never even say all these words. Anyway, they made homemade corn tortillas, and it, you know, I mean, by the time you leave the table, you're like staggering. This year, they actually put to-go boxes on the table because it's just, it's so much. So I had an extra dinner the next day. So that's lots of fun. It's always in a hotel in the Des Moines area, and 600 people show up for it.
A good thing to celebrate. So three cheers for the farmers.
Well, and it's a, like, Nyman Ranch was recognized by Fast & Company this year as one of the best companies to work for in the country. And, you know, I was thrilled to see that because normally those recognitions do not go to anything agricultural or having to do with farmers. And Nyman Ranch has a great model because the farmers raise their pigs. I mean, they have standards and help the farmers to, you know, be better at what they do. But, you know, the farmer still owns the pigs, and then he has a market for them where he gets a premium price. There are a few other, you know, I don't know if we've talked about this, but in most, like in CAFOs and in chicken operations, a lot of these large-scale industrial things, the farmer actually doesn't even own the animal. They're sent the baby animal. They're sent the food, which does not give them any control over what's going on the farm and, frankly, doesn't pay very well. So Nyman Ranch is really good. There are other models for this, like, for example, Organic Valley, which is the largest cooperative structured business in the world, is the same thing. It's farmers, family farmers, who are producing all of the things for the dairy products. And actually they also do meat and other, you know, it's the largest corporate cooperative structure in the world. That's so, you know, these are good models for us to know about and understand and support these business practices because it helps farmers.
Very good. Good. Well, that sounds like a lovely gathering to be part of.
Oh, it's tons of fun.
And three cheers for everyone.
Yeah, lots of people that we know. I mean, half the audience is farmers. The other half is sort of either local food activist kinds of people. So there were lots of people that we know from local foods and, you know, local luminaries like Neil Hamilton. And I was just saying, Steve Simpkin, who's our Iowa Press, Ice Cube Press, was there with his wife. And then there are some national people who show up because, of course, it's a marketing event for Nyman. So they have speakers, and it's really, really interesting.
Very good. Thanks for the report.
Yes.
That's good.
Yum, yum, yum.
So where did the summer go? Let's think about putting away a little summer for the winter. We'll be glad we did.
Oh, we are in the onslaught part of it.
Oh,
right?
My goodness. There's all kinds of things to do. Donna, take it away.
Oh, well, so I'll tell you what I'm doing right now because my friend Helen Gunderson, every time I come down into my kitchen, there's more produce in there, you know, peppers, tomatoes, peaches, plums, tomatoes, tomatoes, tomatoes. So we're making a lot of candied tomatoes. That's Lana and I'm leaning towards roasting a lot of things this year.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Not only am I roasting the tomatoes, slow roasting. I did peaches that way this year. I really liked it. So The peaches I just cut in half. I did not take the skins off. I just took the pit out, lined them all up on the baking trays, which had been, they have just a layer of, I just used olive oil underneath it. And then on top, I lined them all up with the cut side up, and I took a mixture that was sugar, cardamom, a dash of salt and pepper, not much, and I used some citric acid in it, too.
Good idea.
I've not worked with that for years and years, but lately, it gives that tang that you want sometimes. It just perks it up a little bit. And I kept I did one tray with cardamom and one tray with, something rose, powdered rose leaf or something. So you can change the flavors. You don't want too much because you want the peach. It comes out tasting like a little bite of peach pie.
That's a good idea. And we're talking about this, not just roasting this stuff. So picture a cookie sheet or a big tray with roasted half peaches on it. But this is a nice way to freeze things.
Yes, and the two, ones that you don't gobble up immediately, you can just put I hate using plastic, but for this I'm using plastic because I have broken way too many glass jars in the freezer. So this kind of, actually the peaches didn't even need to be that slow roasted. I just roasted them at 350 till they were, started to shrivel and, longer than you would bake a pie probably. But that worked out really well. Also, to finish off the peaches, because there was a lot of peaches, just a glorious bounty from Helen. I cooked these, I did peel. I peeled and quartered. I didn't want to make jelly or jam, so I decided to make peaches in syrup. You know, like you would have on the table at Thanksgiving or something, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Usually you can them. And I put, I cooked it down with a little bit of lemon verbena, sugar, pepper, and salt. Not too much, of course. And some cornstarch, right? Mm-hmm. And I cooked them down with that. The cornstarch, I picked the pieces out, the peach, and took just the syrup and then thickened it and cooked that up again and then poured it over. And then at the end, when I was done, I poured some Benedictine and brandy over them. So I have brandied peaches, but instead of, like regular brandy, if you use B&B, it's called Benedictine and brandy, it's sweeter than brandy and it's wonderful with peaches. I have done it with cherries too.
This sounds like some good Christmas coming
exactly.
up, Donna.
Oh, if boy. I can manage not to eat it all, I hope to put a container away for Christmas.
Good. Okay, so what happened? You put this in a container, and then is this goes in the freezer, goes in a dark shelf, or what?
Well, it has to go in the freezer eventually, but I have to say I ate some for breakfast.
It's never going to make it.
Well, the containers were a little bit full to freeze, so I thought, I'll just have a portion, for breakfast, and had to see for sure if I liked the taste. Yes, I liked the taste. It was a good one.
Good one.
And then plums are in now. We have damps and plums also from Helen. I'm halfway through it. I haven't finished it, but I've cooked it down. I just throw all the plums in the pot, little bit of water to get it going, and some sugar, again, a little pinch of salt and a pinch of pepper. And I put rose geranium leaves in that because that is one of my favorite jams in the world. So now it's cooked down, and I'll put them in mill where I run it's a hand mill, mm-hmm, right? So I will press the pulp through and pick the seeds out and so I'll have kind of a jammy plum thing, which is really good. Then there's peppers.
Yes.
What do you do with peppers?
Well, I dry quite a few of them because I like hot peppers dried, but I also roast them in the oven and freeze them. Because
these are sweet. I was thinking of roasting them because I love roast peppers.
You can. Peppers are wonderful. You can just slice them up, put them on a cookie sheet, and put them in the freezer and bag them later because it's kind of nice to freeze some mm-hmm. things all separate mm-hmm. because they'll freeze fast. That's fine, but I find I use them more if they are roasted a little bit. But like I say, especially hot peppers, I love to dry them in my food dryer, and then it, make sure they're really, really dry, and then grind them up because I know what my peppers taste like, and I know what that pepper seasoning is going to taste like. So that's my pepper thing.
Well, yeah, then if they're ground, you can use just a pinch or something.
Yeah, yeah. You run across an interesting thing in the New York Times
said they were talking about freezing things too. And a lot of these are tricks that she talks about freezing garlic. Lana and we
do that.
Yeah, we do that because Lana grows such great garlic. But she peels them, which I used to do before she freezes them. We have since moved on to just breaking them into individual cloves and freezing them with their little coats on. And I think that's frankly a better way because the peels come off really easily once they're thawed. And, when you're peeling them while they're still fresh, you will press them a little bit and, you know, you don't want to nick them or anything. So I think our method is better. She did mention there was this one trick Lana and I liked.
Well, there's also freezing herbs, which I do that. What a great idea. You chop things up, put them in a ice cube tray, and then after things are frozen, you have a little chunk of mixed herbs or cilantro or parsley chopped up in a little square, and then I dump them out and wrap them in a little plastic and put them in a freezer bag. That my trick with that is remembering that I have them in the freezer.
What are those little green things?
So yeah, so that's the tricky part. But that works just fine to preserve herbs. Don't let them just kind of go to their demise out in the garden. You can bring them in and freeze them.
I prefer to freeze pesto. If I'm going to do something with basil, I tend to make it into pesto and freeze that. Otherwise, I dry my basil. Mm-hmm. And there was one other thing that she was doing. I did this for 2 years running now, and I'm sticking with it for things like thyme. I put it in a 1 cup mason jar with salt, large. Like flaky salt is best, not the finely ground stuff. And just, you know, pluck the little leaves off, and put it into salt and shake it up really good and keep shaking. And you have to keep that in the refrigerator, but it does go a long time. So I'm all for salting.
Ah, very good.
Some of those really small, delicate things like thyme and stuff like that.
Good. Oh, there was another thing about, and this was, of course, pictures on this thing are great. It was rolling up.
She's rolling up things. She's rolling up parsley and then the whole leaves into a tight roll and then putting it in a small freezer bag. So you end up with like a log of it and cutting it off. I think that might be a decent way to use basil.
Yeah, yeah. Freeze it quickly.
Yeah, yeah. And she says this, and this is true for all the herbs that you want to freeze. You pick the stems out so you really only have the leaves, and you give them a quick rinse, and then you dry them in the salad dryer because you really don't want in the spinner because you don't want water on them when you freeze them. But what I liked about this roll thing is then you take the roll out and you can cut off as much as you need.
Yeah, it looks like a little fat green cigar, but the idea of squishing it out of the bag and cut off what you need.
Well, and you end up with, like, there's a technique called a chiffonade, which is where you do this with fresh basil leaves most commonly. You do make a roll of them, and then you slice your knife through them. So you're not just getting a chopped herb. You're getting a very thin, like, little, you know, sometimes up to 1 inch long, which makes a really lovely garnish on a lot of things. Now, with it frozen, you're not going to use it for a garnish. But
that's a good way to chop up. Good way to use it, I think.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have to use the whole thing all at once.
Yeah.
Excellent. See, we get help from all sorts of things.
Oh, yes, the New York Times. Sometimes we know more than they do, but sometimes they have great ideas.
So good.
Yeah, like, oh, no, we already tried. No, we know a better way than that. But Well, you know, Lana and I, at this point, we have a lot of experience with some of this stuff, you know?
It's fun to find out what other people are doing.
It is.
Yes. So think about freezing those herbs and use that freezer. You don't have to do a whole bunch at once. You can do a little bit. That's fine.
Yeah, and the herbal things don't take up that much space in the freezer.
Yeah. Donna talked about salting things, and I have a recipe here I want to share because I'm trying a new thing here. It's called a pepper mash, and I got it from a publication put out by Seed Savers Exchange from Decorah, Iowa. And besides growing things, they're big on eating things too. So one of their staff members, they're in education and engagement manager named Janine Schaefer, sent along this recipe called a pepper mash. And it's, like I said, I like my hot peppers. And I was looking for new ways to do this. And, of course, everything comes at once, so I've got lots of peppers now. So this is making it on the countertop in a jar. We're kind of making a fermented, salted pepper mash that you can kind of treat like kimchi or treat it like
sauerkraut. It is like a sauerkraut.
It's like a sauerkraut.
It's just only peppers, right?
It's just peppers. So, ingredients, peppers and salt, and a canning jar, a quart jar. Clean your peppers and remove the stem and pit from them. Remove the seeds if you like or keep them in. And weigh your peppers and then mash them. This is a wide suggestion here. Either a food processor, mortar and pestle, or a knife. So I use the knife. Mine is just in chunks as opposed
to
mush.
Beautiful looking.
Chunks. I have chunks. Then mix in salt in a 5% to 8% salt by ratio. So whatever your peppers were, 5% to 8%. You guess.
So did you weigh your peppers?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. And then, you know, put in some. Layer it. I used a nice chunky sea salt for this. Press the mash into a jar, leaving 1-inch head space. Screw the jar down tightly. Leave the jar somewhere convenient.
So there's no liquid in that. No.
They produce their own liquid. I thought it's not doing anything, but by the second day, the whole jar is full of liquid. Okay, and you have to burp the mash daily.
Which means you have to take the lid off
and
let the air out and put it back on.
Yeah. And then after 1 to 2 weeks, the fermentation will likely have calmed down and you can store it in the refrigerator. Very good. I'm looking forward to tasting this. Now, I used about 2/3 hot peppers, some of my favorites, and I had a bunch of...
Oh, this is hot.
Yes, this is hot.
Whoa.
I want to use this for seasoning. And then, a chunk of it is some sweet peppers. That's because I'm not all that adventuresome with hot peppers. So, you can... It says you can keep it fermenting, but I'm going to kind of see how this goes. I did this like 3 days ago, and I'm so proud of myself.
It
looks like the picture. I love it when they send pictures with recipes. And thanks to the people at Seed Savers Exchange for this pepper mash. It's a salted pepper ferment that happens on your counter. Oh, we'll be back with more Donna Lana Kitchen, more stuff. This is KHOI, and this is Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking about putting food by. Summer is kind of going. Here we are at the end of summer. We're thinking about putting food by. And that song is, that tune you just heard is called Closing the Cottage, which is kind of a little lament about summer ending there. Oh, you know, those that have summer places to go. But it's a sweet tune, so we'll hear more of that later. But, Donna, you have something to say about salting.
There's a fairly new cookbook by an author that I really, really like, Naomi Duguid, who's Canadian, has had lots of great books. Her new book is, Salt, the Miracle of Salt. And it's all about techniques for salting and preserving food. So it will be coming, and when I receive it, Lon and I will both eagerly read it, and then we will report back on that book.
Oh, good, yeah. Lots of good food books. I've got a few kind of stacking up, too.
Well, and this is not recipes. It's more like the
techniques.
Yeah, techniques. I mean, there'll be recipes in it, but
That's good. Yeah. That's good. Well, I have a report from the Wheatsfield Food Cooperative Local Foods Potluck and Picnic that happened this last weekend. We happened to hit a gorgeous weekend. The Local Foods Potluck is always a nice thing to look forward to in the fall.
This is the Wheatsfield one.
The Wheatsfield Potluck, yes. The Local Foods Potluck. And it was a lovely day, beautiful day in the park. Nice and shady, and music was provided by a band called Two Guys Named Dave and Steve. So there were three guys. Lovely, it was lovely.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, you run out of things to call yourself when
you're a
band.
Yeah, that's a very Midwestern, low-profile kind of promotion.
They did good stuff. A saxophone, a trombone, and an electric bass. Guitar. They played a lot of oldies, and it was good. Anyway, it was nice. We had a gathering there, and the food co-op provided sloppy joes. There was a vegetarian sloppy joes or local beef sloppy joes. And as usual, when we asked around, so who grew some of this stuff that is on the potluck table? Hands went up all over.
Oh, good.
I remember the first local Wheatsfield potluck was way back at, 2014, 2015. I remember going there and actually recording some things, and at that potluck, it was a big, big new thing was that they were actually having local beers. 10 years ago, that was a big thing, local breweries, but that happened, and we hadn't had one in a while because of COVID and whatever, but we were celebrating this time, and there we were. There was good stuff. Donna, there was a service berry pie.
Oh!
Juneberry pie. Now, juneberries are these small, prolific little things that happen.
And it was a good juneberry year, but most of mine,
They're not all that fancy. They're great to eat out of hand, but this was a nice pie base with a sprinkled
tiny.
Pie.
Tiny,
and tiny.
And they do not have a strong flavor.
No. And whoever did it, kudos to them, because it was not overpowered by sugar or anything. It was just plain tasty. So, and also, although we were supposed to write down everything and put up a little sign by our dish, you know how that happens. People come and things go and the little signs get lost. There was an interesting creamy tomatilla tortilla casserole. So it was sort of like an enchilada, but more loose, like you went after it with a spoon. What was nice...
So tomatillas instead of tomatoes.
Yes. And this was a really good thing. As a dish, it looked like a dish, but it didn't look all that great. But boy, were those tasty.
I love tomatillas. Yep. We don't get enough of them. They're a little too rare.
That was a fine find. And actually, Donna, some of your roasted peaches actually showed up.
Oh, yeah. Helen took some. I mean, they were her peaches after all.
They were also a big hit. There was a good time had by all. So it's nice to get together and celebrate.
I just want to, you did mention a key component of preserving. You talked about not being overwhelmed by too much sugar.
Right.
A lot of recipes for jams and jelly use, I think, too much sugar.
Yeah.
Because then you put it on your toast or whatever, and the overwhelming sensation is just sweet rather than the flavor of the fruit. One of the luxuries, because now if you're buying your jam or jelly at the store, you're going to get super sweet because sugar is way cheaper than the fruit. But if you're making it at home and you've harvested it off of your tree, you have the luxury of making it, as we would say, fruit forward. So use less sugar than it's called for. You can always add sugar, but start slowly with the sugar and keep it as little sugar as possible, because then you will get more fruit flavored. So if you're following recipes, don't necessarily adhere to what is printed. You use some of your own. Now, sugar will affect the gelling quality, right?
Yes, especially for the packaged jello, the packaged pectin that you get. However, there are a lot of options now. You can buy low sugar pectin.
Ah, good idea.
Which doesn't mean no sugar.
Right. We're not saying no sugar. We're just saying cut it back, because you will get more flavor out of your fruit, especially, you know, if you've got a lot of fruit. Goody, goody, goody.
Yeah. Why not? And you're standing there and you can taste it as you go along, and it's pretty darn good. You can, like I said, there are low sugar pectins available. Some even say no sugar. But as I'm tasting, I always like a little sugar for taste anyway.
Oh, a little sugar, yes.
But you can get the little recipe thing out of the pectin box. And
is that
you
the Pomona's one? Is the
Pomona's
is the low sugar
actually
pectin. Yeah.
Ball, the company, is putting out a low sugar pectin.
Excellent.
And I'm practicing with that, and that's working out real well. But if you pull out the recipes that have been with the pectin for ages, you'll find that they call for, believe it or not, a cup of fruit to a cup of sugar.
Whoa.
And so your teeth kind of hurt there. So, I mean, just kind of generally across the board.
Yeah, you don't have to do that.
No, because actually what happens, the pectin helps it gel, and acid, adding lemon juice helps for low acid.
Could you use citric acid
for
that
too?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yes, you could.
Yeah. Okay.
Very good. Also, where were we? Oh, at the potluck. Yes, back to the potluck, everybody. I went to the potluck picnic this last weekend, and I took a raw okra salad.
Whoa.
And so I decided to be really, really courageous here. I love raw okra. And I figured, well, everybody else should, too.
Part of the deal is because Lana grows the most beautiful, perfect okra in the world.
I love okra.
And you pick them small.
Yeah, this is
which
small.
Which is really is good small. Because it makes a huge textural difference.
Okay, first time I've made this. So I followed a recipe that I found in the Whole Okra book. The Whole Okra, A Seed to Stem Celebration by Chris Smith. And it's been my okra book. It's got about okra, how to grow, what to do with it, how to cook with it, how to seed save. This guy just loves his okra. But this is called a raw okra salad from 1916. Get
Whoa.
This. There is nothing new under the sun, folks. This was an original recipe was found from a collection in the Waldorf Astoria.
Oh, my. So
in 1916, believe it or not.
Salad.
And it kind of made the rounds with women's magazines in the early 1900s. It was the thing. USDA Farmers Bulletin put this out, and how these pods are good for you. And anyway, so there's nothing new under the sun. Raw okra salad from 1916. Here's the recipe. 2 cups thinly sliced raw okra, 1 cup diced tomatoes, 1 cup chopped cucumbers, 1 to 2 cups finely chopped onions. I didn't use that many onions. I probably used just one big onion. Then for the dressing, clove garlic, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon pepper, 2 tablespoons vinegar, 1/3 cup olive oil. It goes together really easily. I toss this stuff, save the tomatoes, and put them in later, just before I went to the potluck. But just making a raw dressing salad thing and toss everything.
So if you're not cooking the okras, they don't slime out, right?
Okay, here's a note.
Ah.
They did.
Oh!
Just a little bit. It was because it was hit with vinegar, that does help a lot.
Yeah.
But I noticed, for me, it was wonderful because there's so much going on in this salad. It says if you want to, you can boil the okra first, just a 1 or 2 minute blanching, the little chunks, and that will take care of any slime that anybody would be object to. But I didn't do it on this one because I thought, let's just hit them with all two barrels.
Well, yeah, and I would think that the dressing itself, of course, is going to lend moisture. So,
oh yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So you liked it? Oh, I'll have to try it.
And the tomatoes had acid in them,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, so the stuff that you have this time of year, use it. Raw okra and...
What kind of vinegar did you use?
Apple cider vinegar, in this case.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Because actually, as I made this, and as set, these kind of salads, they suck up the taste later. By the time I got to the potluck, I wish I would have added more... Something like, oh, I don't know, a seasoned salt or a little bit of more oomph, more salt. It could have used something.
You know, often like potato salads, yeah. Pasta salads, you make them and they taste great. Then 2 hours later, they taste flat.
Yeah.
It is because the vinegar has been absorbed, particularly with potato salad and mm-hmm. pasta salads. It absorbs into the starches. And so I always re-season, especially with whatever acid I'm using, just before I serve it.
Yes. So this is a simple thing, but I would goose up the taste a little bit better. But the texture of it, and I really like this. Again, raw okra salad from 1916. And this is from The Whole Okra, A Seed to Stem Celebration by Chris Smith. I have been referring to this book for quite a few years. I really enjoy this author. He's funny. And also, I've loaned this book to many people, and I'm always kind of careful about it. I want to get it back.
Make sure you get it back.
Yeah, get it
right,
back.
Right.
This book has kind of made the rounds around people. There's always something to learn about okra.
I think we did a whole show on it.
We did a whole show on it way back when I first got this book. So, there, okra. Very good. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're going to listen to a little bit of something from the archives. We sort of have a potpourri of things here to share with you today. In 2016, I did an interview with a friend of mine who lived here in Ames. She gives us some thoughts on taste from India. Her name is Geeta Iyer, and she's a cook and a writer. She's a graduate of the Iowa State University Master of Fine Arts Program in Creative and Environmental Writing, as that program was called way back then. And
I think it still is.
It still is. Okay. And then, way back when I first was interviewing Geeta, I had the good fortune of eating some of her good Indian food. She reads us a poem. She talks about her food history and tells us why curry is a verb.
Do you have something to share with us today?
Yes, I do. I have a poem here. It's actually an excerpt from a much longer poem that's about sort of my connection to my food history, because I'm from the south of India, and so I was thinking a lot about sort of the kind of foods that we make, how we learn to make them, and also about sort of like the languages, particularly my mother tongue, Tamil. It's a South Indian language from Chennai, which used to be called Madras when I was growing up, and so sort of like in learning how to make dishes from my family history, I was also sort of tapping into the language in which those dishes were conveyed to me, and sort of, you know, relearning my language in a way, because most of what I do is speak in English, but I miss, you know, sort of thinking and speaking in Tamil as well. And so this is a part of that poem. The poem's called Mapping the Tongue. It was published in the Mid-American Review, and the part that I'm going to read to you is part six. The poem is organized around how South Indians sort of classify tastes. There are six tastes in India, in the way that we classify them. We have bitterness, sweetness, sourness, saltiness, spiciness, and something that's harder to describe, astringency, sort of, you know, dryness. And so the part of the poem that I'm going to read to you is about dryness. There are a couple of words in there that are in Tamil, and one of them is Amamma, which is my grandmother. So this is a poem that's about her and some of the stuff that I learned from her. So part six. Torpe, that which remains. Next time you bite into a still raw banana, consider how its meat clings like drying glue to each pink bud of flesh on your tongue. Or drink from that forgotten cup of black tea left by the stovetop, the wick of the thread sprouting from the teabag, now tanned and hardened, the liquid like bone meal, a rasp inside your mouth. Or go to Madras, where they harvest heavy lobes of purple-red banana hearts. Shuck the spiraled sepals. Each sheath unveils banana flowers, pale as baby fingers. Slice them away from the stem. Dice the flowers. Let the pieces soak in a large orange plastic bowl filled with water from the tap. Remember, Amamma had a trick for making precious little stretch, curried banana flowers with ground lentils for bulk. She said to eat slowly, parting meat from grit. Even today, the memory lingers. Mother tongue, like after apples, filming the teeth.
There is a wonderful world of tastes out there. And on the show, we like to talk about different kinds of tastes. And Sugita, you were born in southern India, but you've traveled a lot since then. And you bring a wonderful history of cooking and spices and knowledge of things. So tell me about your cooking history.
Okay, so I come from a South Indian family from Chennai, but we moved to Mumbai now before I was born, and so we're sort of, you know, Mumbai Madrasi people. It's sort of like hard to define because people tend to travel a lot, and so a lot of my cooking heritage comes from South India, but there's also a lot of, you know, mix with northern cuisines, and so that's sort of what I grew up eating. I myself did not learn how to cook until I was about 23, because I spent the majority of my life thinking, I don't want to do this because it seems like this is what women do, and then this is all that they do, and I don't want to end up being that sort of person. And I was quite ashamed to find out that many of my friends here in the United States, a lot of them were vegetarian or vegan, they were making these exquisite dishes for potlucks and things, and I would come in with Chips Ahoy and Tostitos, and it just made me feel really embarrassed that I have, you know, a lot of food that I could contribute, but it's stuff that my mom knows how to make and not I. And so I spent the next years sort of, you know, calling my mom up on Skype and saying, can you tell me how to make this or that? And so learning again all of the stuff that I just sort of like happened in the background and that I took for granted. And So
your taste buds knew it, your nose knew it.
Yeah.
But you did.
Constructing my childhood.
So did it work?
It did. It's not quite as good as what my mom does because she sort of got it down to a science. But it's been really nice to sort of learn that I can, you know, recreate the things that I miss, particularly like in wintertime when I miss hot, spicy food and when I need to be comforted. You know, it's really nice to know that I can do that myself now.
That's wonderful. So tell me about curry and what makes a curry? It seems there's all different kinds.
So curry is, if you ask an Indian, curry is a complicated thing. Curry is different depending on who you speak to in India. In the south, where I'm from, curry tends to be what we refer to in terms of dry vegetables that are sort of mixed with spices. In the north, it tends to be vegetables in a wet gravy. But curry, I also like to think of as a verb because it's not necessarily like the combination of spices that you put in, but the fact that you are making a mix of spices to go with any vegetable dish that you have. And so the curry powder that you find in a supermarket is really sort of the simplest, blandest excuse for the vast variety of things that you can do when you decide to curry vegetables.
Oh, so the curries, the little bottle that says curry would kind of like being putting ketchup on everything.
Pretty much, yeah. It's like ketchup instead of the wide variety of sauces you can make with tomatoes. So, yeah. And I think that one of the main problems with that, with like the curry you buy in a store, is that it tends to over-dominate with turmeric. And turmeric tends to be sort of like, you know, more of a, you use it with restraint. And so you pick different things to use in curry. There's one other thing that curry is that mostly only Indians know about. It's also a tree. It forms these leaves, the sort of dark glossy green leaves on a stem. They smell like nothing that it can really describe. It's, I guess, like the closest thing that I would come to is sort of like a mix between juniper and pepper. It's sort of oils, really fragrant oils, sort of like this mild, crispy spiciness.
These are the leaves.
Yeah,
the
these
tree.
Are the leaves. Yeah, and so this is something that, you know, it's a tree that's native to India, and my mom had one in her garden in Dubai, and so every summer or so she would harvest leaves off of it and dry it on, you know, like a large table of curry leaves that she'd let air dry, and then she'd powder them and then send packages to me, to my sister, and that's one of those spices that is relatively hard to get here in the United States, but is absolutely wonderful to use in cooking.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. On this tree, there's a fruit, too, or a nut?
Yeah, I believe there's a fruit. I believe it produces small white flowers and little, I think they're sort of greenish, brownish fruit. I think you can eat the flowers. I'm not sure if you can eat the fruit, but the leaves are the thing that you primarily use.
The leaves. Who would have known?
Yeah.
That's great. So tell me about some of your favorite tastes. You mentioned you're a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. So you know how to put this stuff with vegetables.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, in keeping with sort of how you use curries, sort of the basic stuff that we do at home, the simplest sort of curried dish that you can make involves just sort of sautéing mustard seeds in oil and then throwing in your diced vegetables into that and then adding some chili powder and some turmeric, about, you know, a half teaspoon of turmeric and, say, a teaspoon of chili powder or more, depending on your spice levels. And so that's sort of like a very basic dish that is incredibly satisfying. Anything that you do on top of that is just sort of a variation. And so you can throw in coriander seed powder. You can throw in cumin seeds. You can throw in cloves, bay leaves, cinnamon, pretty much anything that you can think of in your spice rack. And that sort of like alters and varies the flavor. And so a lot of the dishes that I like to make that come from India are variations on that sort of like basic set of spices to what you're making.
Oh, it seems like all these dishes delight the nose, delight the eyes. It's really, really wonderful. Speak about heat. when you get to the Midwest here, mm-hmm. we're always so afraid that it's way too spicy. Yeah, it's way too hot. Mm-hmm. Heat, chili powders are an acquired taste. But
yeah, I think it helps to sort of, you know, you build up a tolerance to it. And like for someone like me, you build up a tolerance for it from when you're like a 1 year old. And so you can handle quite a lot of spice. But what I've found when I've tried to cook for people who can't tolerate spice, if I don't use chili powder, I end up using more of the other ingredients, so for example, cumin and coriander seed and clove and things like that. And so you start bringing out all of these other flavors in the food, and that's just as good. You don't need to burn your tongue off to enjoy a dish. It's just one other way of, you know, appreciating food. And so it's possible to sort of minimize how much chili powder you use and still get, you know, heartiness out of a dish.
That's great.
And the other thing, you know, the chili powder that Indians tend to use the most is Kashmiri chili powder, which tends to be a milder chili by our standards, and it provides as much color as it does flavor. So a lot of times you add it for the redness that it gives to food. And I think that that's important. Like the color of the food that you're eating can be just as soothing as the food itself.
That was a little bit from our archives about curry and why curry is a verb. That was an interview with Geeta Iyer, a past Ames resident, but now continuing her travels around the world. She lives lots of places and has lots of different adventures. So to hear the full interview with Geeta Iyer, you can go to our Danelana Kitchen Archives, which you can find on the KHOI website, khoifm.org. Go to the talk section, go to the Danelana Kitchen section, and look for the 2016 archives. Lots of good stuff there to share. And we also have a podcast.
Yes, if you want to listen to this in a podcast format, and it's more convenient for you, just go to wherever you listen to podcasts and put in Danelana, that's one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, second word, kitchen. And there you will have us in your ears.
Very good. Donna, you have an upcoming event for us here.
Yeah, this came from my friend Rick Exner, who works a lot on immigration issues. And at the Ames United Church of Christ, there is going to be a speaker, the Reverend Dr. Miguel de la Torre, and he's also doing a lecture at ISU. So the ISU lecture is Friday, September 15th. It's called Why They Come, Exploring the Immigration Crisis at the Southern Border, 6 o'clock at the MU. And then there's a conference all day at the church. And then I believe he's also speaking at their Sunday worship service on the 17th at the 10 o'clock service.
That's the UCC Church, a kitty corner across from the post office.
Yeah, and so this is let's say it's a very compassionate understanding of why we are in an immigration crisis. And this not only applies to our southern borders, but, you know, there are migrants moving all over the world, and a lot of them are coming from really unbearable situations because of either climate change or politics or both. So this is a really good opportunity and aims to kind of hear things that maybe you're not seeing in the newspaper all the time.
Yes. Always good to talk.
Yes. September 15th is at the MU, and then the 16th is an all-day workshop. And then the 17th, you could go to the worship service and hear him preach.
Thank you, Dana. You've been listening to the Danelana Kitchen. We've been talking about, well, a whole potpourri of things. Today we've been talking about how to preserve things. Donna talked about Nyman Ranch.
Yeah, it's a busy time of year.
And we talked about a potluck, and we dug into the archives for a little bit on curry. Good music by the Barnow Band. Goodbye, summer. Happy Labor Day. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas. Oh, and there's a full moon tomorrow night.
Oh, thank you.
On Wednesday.
Yep. Engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.